Tom Gerhart and Dan Provost are the guys behind Studio Neat. On this show, we discuss entrepreneurship, product design, and all of the ups and downs that come with running a small business. I'm Mike Hurley, and this is Thoroughly Considered. So Thoroughly Considered is not an interview show. Except for the fact that we kind of just all talk together and maybe I ask a bunch of questions to Tom and Dan. But we're gonna park that to the side because we have a guest for the very first time. And it's Mr. Max Temkin. Hi, Max. Welcome to Thoroughly Considered.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Welcome aboard.
So we were talking about like maybe having some guests on the show a while ago. And we ended up deciding that the very best person to have as a guest for our first guest would be you, Max. So you've got, you know, just setting a high bar.
All right. Well, I already have front matter and follow up for the crew here.
Okay.
Good. Would you like to address that before we begin?
I'm only perpetually about 6 months behind on listening to all of my podcasts, but I went and caught up with the show because I knew I was coming on. I listened to the other day the episode where you guys were talking about the email form.
I was
really outraged. And you know, Mike, you know, you don't know what you're doing, so I expect this from you. But Tom and Dan, like, yeah. I can't even say I'm mad, I'm just disappointed in you guys, because like an email form, like, I do think we've kind of figured this out with cards, and the thing with an email form, it's like anything else, it's copywriting and design. I don't know why wasn't that on the table.
Well, so it's
why were you bickering over like the dumbest thing is whether you opt people in or not? Like the better question is like why would people want to be on the list? And that's a design and copywriting question. You guys are the best at that.
Well, I wouldn't say the best, but it's it's interesting. So we're using Shopify for our store, and for the longest time, and I think even still, we actually couldn't change like any of the copy on the checkout screen. So we were basically kind of stuck. Like our only option was check this box, yes or no.
Yeah, we had like very little agency. But we found there's like a hack for anyone out there. You can quote translate all the text like it would be another language, but then you can change it. It's like this weird hack that we found. It's like so dumb. So yeah, that's
that just sounds like the very worst thing.
it's just ridiculous. There's like lots of problems, but.
Well, I think you guys were running into a case. Like I was just listening to that conversation go in circles, and I was so frustrated because you guys have the tools to fix this, but it's like, I guess it was really a Shopify problem because you know it's like a situation where if all you have is a hammer, like every problem is the only decision point you guys have is do you opt people in or not, and so that was like the only thing you could argue about. But like,
yeah,
right. Like the thing we always think about is like. Well, I know why it's good for us that our customers sign up for our mailing list, but why is it good for them? And then we tell them that, and then they sign up, like almost 100%. And I don't think we do check the box by default, but almost everyone who checks out does tick the box.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, that's like the best point. I mean, like that is obviously the point, but yeah, I guess we should have been more clear about our like silly predicament we were in with like this like checkbox is like the only decision matter. But I mean, it was also, I think it was a little bit interesting because it was like, you know, we fight that much about a checkbox. Like imagine how much we bicker about like, you know, something like that or like picking typefaces or something. It just
did you guys bicker that much about the product design?
No.
No, yeah. Of course you don't. Of course you don't, because you have a common language and you're designers, and when the right solution reveals itself after consideration and research, it's obvious what to do.
Well, usually. Sometimes.
Bust it.
Straight up bust it.
That's why we have you on, Max.
That's right. Come on and set us straight.
We can finally put that argument to bed. So, Mr. Temkin, in your bio, in your biography of yourself, I guess if you were to give one line to a newspaper or something, I would assume what would you call yourself? If you're going to say like, if someone says like, what are you? What do you do for a living? Like, how do you describe that? What is like the kind of the one or two words that you would use to describe what you do, how you think of yourself as a somebody in the workforce?
That's a very fraught question. I actually really don't know how to answer that. Like I used to say I'm a designer, but the truth is like, I don't really do much designing every day anymore. Like I actually go most days, I don't open InDesign or Illustrator or anything on my computer. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I don't know what exactly I am. I make games, and mm-hmm. I work in politics, and I sometimes design things.
So you've fallen right into my trap, because I think that many people would think of you or call you basically like the role of a CEO. I think that's probably how people look at you and think of your role at Cards Against Humanity. And how do you reconcile that based upon the way that you think about what you do?
Yeah, well, we don't have a CEO. Cards is a very, very unusual company. We vote on things, but we prefer not to vote because we prefer that no one be like left out of a decision, basically. So usually we'll sort of reach some sort of compromise where everyone's on board and then proceed with that. And we don't have a CEO. I mean, there's different people in the company are responsible for different things, but everyone is sort of accountable to the group. And this isn't like prescriptive. Like I don't really recommend this for any. I don't think anyone else should set up a company this way, but it works for us. We've also been friends with each other since like first grade, so we have a very, very, very long and trusting relationship. We were all like bullied by the same bullies. So I don't know. So yeah, but I'm not the CEO. I mean, my job in Cards is so here's the thing is when we started working on this, like none of us had ever made a product. None of us had ever made, some of the guys didn't really even have job experience because they were still in school. And like, you know, I had like worked on some political campaigns and I worked at Radio Shack and had a bunch of those kind of jobs. And so that was, so I basically took over the like, I would say like the outward facing stuff. So like communications. So like, you know, I don't know, like writing press releases and writing copy on the website and doing social media and stuff like that. That just became, and like, oh, answering customer service emails, like things where we had to talk to the outside world just became the thing that I did. But you guys know how much more is involved in a business, and that's one, I mean, it's very visible, but it's one, maybe 1/20th of the overall work of running a business. So, you know, among the other 8 guys, like Daniel sort of owns our legal and financial silo. And like, thank God I don't touch that, because we would have gone bankrupt a long time ago. Like I don't have the mind for it, like for the better. And I don't really make, I mean, if we have a really tricky decision, I will weigh in on a financial matter. But day to day, I don't know how much games we sell every day. Like I don't look at it. I don't pay attention. And then, you know, Ben does all of our production and we work together on like packaging design. And Josh is sort of runs all of our meetings and project manages everything. David Pinzoff and Eli Halpern sort of have always run our writers process. So they have this incredibly complicated array of like spreadsheets where we track like every piece of data of like every playtest of every card that we've ever done. So there's a lot of work that has to happen for the company to function. And I just got the slice of the pie where it's the stuff that people see. So they wrongly assume and because of that, like I get more credit than I deserve when things go well, and I get more blame than I deserve when things go poorly. And
yeah, cause I would imagine that you are basically always listed as the creator of Cards Against Humanity.
Yeah. And I'm perpetually like emailing media organizations saying like, you need to change that to co-creator or put the other people's names on. Yeah,
well, I know, but you do a lot of things like Black Box. Is Black Box similar, or but that's just two people, right?
No, Black Box is it's actually, we haven't even spun it off as its own company yet. So yeah, it's just Cards. It's the 8 of us who started it, and same management structure. We've taken on no debt, we've given away no equity, we have no VC, and it's just the 8 of us, and we just run a shipping company. I mean, it's sort of the same infrastructure we built for Cards. And now we make it available to other artists so we ship their stuff for them.
Yeah, which is awesome. We really wanted to do Black Box, but for some stupid technical reasons, it's like hard. So not by you guys, but it was really just Shopify stupid stuff. But it all comes back to Shopify.
That's a big decision that we're going to have. We've sort of punted on this, but someday we will have to make a decision of, do we want to be a shipping service that plugs into Shopify? And we're not right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's really the main thing.
That will be a major like inflection point for the whole company, because the argument for doing it is that almost everyone in the world uses Shopify. And if we plugged into Shopify, we would have way more customers and we would make more money. But the argument against it, and why I'm not in favor of plugging into Shopify, is we sort of lose what's special about our company. Like, I don't want to be some sort of widget in people's production line where it's completely fungible and you can swap it out with another shipping company, because that doesn't play to our strengths. Like, our whole strength is that we're good at, like, the design, the branding, the sales experience, like, you know. So I really fear giving that part of it up, but we you know, but maybe someday that's where we'll wind up.
Yeah, I mean, I, you know, it's funny, really, I think if we were starting over, we would do, you know, something maybe like a Squarespace and then use Blackbox for, you know, fulfillment and order processing and all that stuff. But now we're in this situation where, you know, we used to be at several different warehouse fulfillment companies, and now we've at least consolidated into one. But, you know, the kind of process of, like, now trying to, like, move the website off and, like, change fulfillment is just, like, feels like such a huge thing to move. It's like, and I wonder how many people are in a similar situation where they, like, were on Shopify and, like, whatever, and they, like, recognize that you guys at Blockbox, like, have taste and would like to be there, but it's like this, you know, moving this mountain kind of to, like, actually move. That's kind of where we're stuck, but someday.
That'll be the test of the whole company, because, like, we're never going to reach feature parity with Shopify. Like, Shopify is a, Shopify is a pretty unbelievable piece of technology. And, like, there's so many, it's such a big company. There's so many people who work there, and it does so many things. We'll never do all the things that Shopify does. So I don't know. So then the question is, like, that we're sort of always perpetually, like, wrestling with is, like, well, what's the special thing that only we can do? And then how do we, like, just focus on that?
Yeah. It just sucks when we want that thing. It's like, oh, it's right there. So one thing that I guess this has changed a little bit, knowing a little bit more about kind of how Cards is structured, but one thing I was really curious about is kind of what Mike was alluding to, was I think the way, at least, you talk about the work you do, and it seems like your approach in general to, like, the work you do is, like, how, you know, us and maybe, like, even people making just, like, a small project would approach things. Like, you talk about it like it's a project, and it seems like you're very hands-on, and you're, like, approaching the marketing and everything in the way that someone, like, would approach, like, a small little project. But it seems like the projects you're doing are, like, touching much larger, you know, institutions, be that, like, the political stuff, or, like, major retail with Cards, or, like, global, like, shipping. They're, like, these huge, or, like, major media, I think you probably have to interact with, like, a ton. And so it seems like you approach your work like a lot of probably our listeners do, but it's really kind of playing on this global stage. So, like, how, like, what do you think about that? Like, how does that work? I mean, do you, is that even true? Do you approach it that way, or is it even on purpose the way that you are kind of picking to work on these kind of large stages, or did it just kind of happen that way? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I see where, I mean, I follow your question. I mean, a couple of caveats that I'll say are, one, you're naming the things that have been successful and, like, that people have heard of, but you're not, so those are, like, the three things I've done that people have heard of, but not the 30 projects that, like, didn't work and, you know, nobody's heard of. And, you know, I spend an equal amount of time trying to start, or, you know, investment and energy and money. So, you know, it is kind of a crapshoot. And, like, I'm always a little suspicious of people who have advice of, like, oh, this is, like, the one trick I have for doing, like, some sort of, like, large scale project or whatever. So, like, in terms, I think you're totally right. Like, I do really like thinking of these things as, like, discrete projects and not as, like, you know, like, do you guys watch Shark Tank?
Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
I'm obsessed with Shark Tank.
We have a show called Dragon's Den in the UK, which I think was first. I think that, I know you laugh, I think Dragon's Den was first, so don't be like, ha ha, different animal. No, it's, and so, yeah, it's the same show. People come on and they pitch. I'm going to Wikipedia now to confirm this, but I believe that Dragon's Den was the first, and then Shark Tank was the idea purchased and then turned into something else.
So, I'm obsessed with Shark Tank, and I love it, and it's almost like a, it's almost for me, it's almost like a bunch of lessons of what not to do. But like last night I was watching Shark Tank and a guy came on and he was selling like swimming trunks, and his whole pitch was that it was going to be a lifestyle brand, and he was selling like the swimming trunks lifestyle, and he like came out to like do his business deal wearing like no shirt, and he had a whole product line and a plan to take over the world. And I was like, man, that guy is like way off. Like, just make some shorts. Like, yeah, people probably want your swimming shorts, right? So it's okay. Like, I really like the idea of I'm just really attracted to the idea of small, achievable, focused projects that try to accomplish one end. Because I think when everything is on the table and you could do anything as part of your master plan to like establish a lifestyle brand, you wind up sitting around a lot and going, well, is this the right thing to do or not the right thing to do? Whereas like if you have a clear sense of your values and a clear sense of, you know, focus, and you're like, well, I just want to accomplish this one specific thing, when those decisions come onto your desk, it's more easy to be like, yeah, this is not right for us.
Okay, but what happens when that attitude confronts like Target? Like, so, well, you know,
yeah. No, I mean, I don't know. Like, it's an open question at this point. And I wasn't in favor of going into Target. And I always thought that it would be cooler if we made less money, but people always got our game online. But, you know, the other guys kind of over many years convinced me that to give it a shot. And it's, I don't know. I mean, I think it's probably too soon to say if it's like how much it's like damages the brand or how lame it is versus how much money we're making or how many new people can play the game. Like, there's a lot of factors there, but I don't know. I'm very suspicious of Target.
Interesting. It's not that everyone in the company has exactly the same attitude to some of the product stuff as you. And so it's not just like you are directly reconciling your approach with like then going into like major retail or whatever.
No, right. Exactly. There's eight of us and we have eight. There's eight Jews who make this game. And that means there's about at any given point, there's like 10 opinions and all being expressed loudly and simultaneously at the same moment. So it's not like we're not like the Borg where we all like speak in unison and like, you know, like, no, it's like it's actually the opposite. It's like, it kind of reminds me of, if you guys read the Ed Catmull's book about Pixar,
yeah,
and mm-hmm, the idea that they have the brain trust where they're like, mm-hmm, they can be like candid and adversarial with each other, but in the interest, yep, of a shared creative vision, that's, mm-hmm, the closest description I've read to sort of what it's like to be at these meetings. So it's really heated, right? Like Ben will say, like, if we don't go into Target, we're leaving all this money on the table and we have a responsibility to all these people who work for us and we want the game to keep growing and this is the only way to do it and it's going to kill the company if we don't. And I'll be like, well, all we have is the brand and it's going to kill the brand if we go into Target and it'll destroy us if we do. And then people will sort of, you know, throw their opinions out. But the point isn't that everyone always agrees on what to do. It's that as with anything else, there's never a clear answer of should you go into Target or not, or what font do you choose for a project? There's no right or wrong answer. There's only conditional answers, and the conditional answers depend on the question that you're asking. So that's what having the shared sense of values and the clear idea of what our project is, that's where we can start asking questions of like, well, instead of being like, is it good or bad to go into Target, we can say, well, does going into Target make it so that more people play our game or not? Because, mm-hmm, that's our mission statement, is we want as many people as possible to play our game. That's, mm-hmm, still the mission statement after whatever, we've been doing this for 7 or 8 years. And I think when I started thinking about it like that, and plus one of our other important values is like being able to do funny and absurd stuff in public. And we started to realize that if we went into Target, they would sort of let us like customize the display and shelving and do all this like weird stunts and performances like,
yeah,
nationally in Target.
Yeah, it's a big stage.
Yeah, exactly. And I wasn't thinking of it like that, right? I was only thinking of the lame parts of Target, but not the way that it was a new platform for us to do funny stuff. So anyway, that was where we eventually reached a compromise. And what we said was that if we can have our products like not intermingled with the rest of the stuff in Target, but if we could do a deal with Target where we are on our own, that was a big consideration. Oh, and the other piece was specifically for Target was we just decided early on that we didn't want to do any, we never wanted to do any deals, discounts, or coupons on Cards Against Humanity. Mm-hmm. And part of that was because we offer the game for free as a download online. I just didn't ever want to get into like those coupon things. And I was just, I don't know, I felt like there was something nice about planting our flag and saying the game is worth $25 and it's always that price and it's never another price. And it was that was a tough issue with Target too, because Target sends out circulars and they do store-wide coupons and stuff. And we somehow Ben's a great negotiator and he's really learned a lot about this world and has like good relationships. And he somehow struck a deal with Target where when they do a store-wide promotion, Cards Against Humanity is mentioned. When it's like 20% off at Target, it always says in a little asterisk on the bottom of the ad, except for products from Apple, Lego, and Cards Against Humanity.
Holy moly.
That's so awesome.
So you end up with like the greatest possible marketing by being an exclusion.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's in the small print, but then when I saw that, I was like, oh, these are companies that I really look up to.
Yeah.
And I feel like they have a strong sense of purpose, so this was probably the right decision for us.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Cards Against Humanity frequently comes up in conversations in my household because my partner, Adina, she works in marketing. I have worked in marketing, and we both have just a general interest in kind of good branding and stuff like that. And Cards Against Humanity's branding is almost iconic at this point, you know, and you have an incredible ability to create blockbuster marketing campaigns on a annual basis, and we want to ask you some questions about the holiday campaigns in a moment, but I have a kind of a wider point to that I wanted to discuss. Like the Cards Against Humanity product is, it adapts, but it doesn't change significantly, right? Like you don't cut the cards into a different shape, right? Like they are kind of what they are, right? Like the game is its thing.
We do overhaul the game every year, and so about every year we replace like maybe 50% to 60% of the cards in the game.
Yeah, I mean, so there are new cards, right? So like it is refreshed, so you can play it more. But the product itself isn't being adapted into like wicked and wonderful things.
I see what I follow what you're saying, that it's fundamentally the same game, but we don't just add new cards. Like we actually go through the game and change the cards in the game. So for example, like we had to take out all the Obama cards and write new cards about Trump, right? So
sure. It lives.
It's a living thing. Like whenever you buy it, it's the best version of it that we can make.
But like the question that I wanted to kind of to get to is, at its current point, Cards Against Humanity, are you selling a product or a brand?
Well, I think at this point, specifically what Ben and I do at Cards, Ben is my like co-designer, and we manage most of the sort of these sort of marketing things that you're talking about. Ben and I are basically an advertising agency that has one client, which is a card game. That's sort of how we think about it.
This it's really funny because this is when me and Adina talk about Cards Against Humanity. That's how we refer to the company. Like you are effectively an agency that does very interesting work, but just for yourselves.
Yeah.
And I kind of wonder, how did you get to that point?
Well, there's two things I can point to that were like helpful for me figuring that out, but I can't speak for, I just want to stress, like I'm only one. The biggest thing is that I have 8 really smart people that I get to work with that challenge me and contribute most of the good ideas that we do. Like most of the stuff you're talking about were not my ideas. Most of the execution or the funny lines of copy, not stuff that I did. So I don't mean to claim credit for that. I'm not trying to be humble either. I truly am only contributing 1/8 or sometimes less than 1/8 of the stuff that you see. But so that's the main secret, is that it's like you have these like 8 really funny smart people, and then people give me the credit for it and want to know how it's done. It's like, well, have 8 people who you've been friends with your entire life. Yeah, we're like the funniest people you've ever met, you know. So that's the first part. But okay, so there's 2 things for me personally that help me piece this together. So one of them was I got really lucky, and when I was in high school, I met I went to this like anti-Iraq war protest, and I saw this guy speak, and he was an amazing speaker, and he was against the war in Iraq at a time when that was very, very unpopular. And I went up to him after this rally, and I was like, I really liked what you had to say. And I was in high school. I was like a sophomore in high school. And I was like, he was a state senator. And I was like, if you ever run for anything, I would, any larger office, I would love to like volunteer on your campaign. And he gave me a business card, and that was Barack Obama. And I've been working for that guy ever since. So I worked on the Senate campaign. And then when I was in college, I wound up like leaving school for a while to work on the 2008 Obama campaign. And I started off as an intern, like getting people coffee, and then eventually somehow it turned into I would be in meetings where people would need like websites or design, and I would just start saying, yeah, I could probably figure that out, and because I knew how to make like form signatures and stuff like that using Photoshop. And I just taught myself how to do all that stuff. And then by the end of the campaign, I mean, I was helping contribute to the Obama brand, you know, that iconic like 2008 brand. Mm-hmm. And I think what I took away from that experience was when he announced, you know, I was actually pretty frustrated when Obama announced that he was going to run for president in 2008. Because if you remember, the guy had just gotten elected to the Senate, and that was one of the most exciting things in national politics to me at the time. Mm-hmm. And I felt that this is one of the most promising young people in politics and someone who I want to, you know, work for my whole life. And I thought, this guy is throwing away his entire career on a vanity and an insane, impossible, vain endeavor to run for president. Because first-term senators who haven't even served out their first term simply do not get the nomination. And if they get the nomination, they don't win. Yeah. And I was so mad at George W. Bush, and I just so wanted a Democrat to get elected. And America obviously shared that skepticism, and plus they didn't know the guy, so they just saw this like really goofy looking guy with huge ears, and his name was Barack Hussein Obama, and he was black, and like it just pile on and on and on, and he was just so unconventional and so wrong in every way, like it just simply did not add up. But what the campaign did, so they had this amazing brand that was originally created, the Obama logo was created by Saul Sender, and then the Obama brand was created by sort of my mentor, Scott Thomas. And what this brand did, I think it had a transformative effect on the guy, where the brand was so consistent and so professional and so painstaking and so fresh and evocative that when you saw this guy speak, there was no question in your mind that he was ready to be president. There was such a level of execution and professionalism that it transformed him, and it turned all of his weaknesses and all of the things that were different about him into strengths and into things that were memorable. And it was big ideas like the logo, you know, the sunset logo and the Gotham typeface. Mm-hmm. But it was also small ideas like it was really challenging to get everything on that campaign to be the correct shade of blue, but we did it. And if it wasn't the right shade of blue, it didn't go out. Another, you know, like if the audience was going to be holding signs, they were all going to be holding signs that looked the same. You know, I designed like many of the signs at the Democratic convention that year. And, you know, you bet that we were working with the printer to proof the colors and make sure that everything was, the typefaces were set correctly and the registration was correct. Like that stuff mattered. And it created a cumulative effect in people's mind of convincing them that this guy was more than he was, that he was ready to be president. Mm-hmm. And it transformed his whole thing, in my opinion. And so I just took away from that like design, and design and how, like the story that you're telling about yourself can make you more than you are. So when we started working on cards, you know, normally tabletop games and board games, they're sort of relegated to this like hobby market, right? Like it's like nerds, and it's like there's like a, like what I always tell people is like there's a convention called Gen Con, which is the biggest gaming convention. I think it's like about 100,000 people go to it. And game companies spend all year trying to figure out how to get people at Gen Con to buy their game. And to me, it's like if we do something that only 100,000 people see, that's like, why would we like battle everyone else in that one square inch of real estate, right? It's like thinking too small. It's too provincial. So with cards, we just decided, you know, what if we did this game and it was for everybody? Like we didn't code it as a nerd thing. We just coded it as like a cool thing that normal people did. And then we made the brand that we made the Obama brand for that, right? Like the brand that was like, it already is that. And then I don't know, it just sort of worked. Mm-hmm. It just sort of, people were willing to give it a shot. And the second thing was, then I saw a talk by Jim Kudal about firing all his clients and turning Kudal Partners into a product design studio that does field notes and other projects. And I actually was at that Creative Mornings talk that he gave where he talked about doing that. And I was like, oh, that's kind of what I want to do with my life.
Like a lot of times people talk about, you know, and especially kind of like in this pseudo industry that we're in, right? Sweating the details is like a big... It's like a big phrase, right? Like that everyone tries to think about the little things. Mm-hmm. And I guess the difference for you was you did that at possibly the biggest stage that it can be done.
Yeah.
Right? Like a presidential campaign is about as big as you can get in certain areas, right? But or if you just think about something that's really important, it's really very important. And going to a printer to sweat the details about the color of a poster is like, that is about as high as you can get on that train. And I guess once you've lived that, of course you would do it at all times.
The other piece of this is, so Scott made a book sadly is unavailable now, I think, but it was called Designing Obama, and it was sort of the Obama style guide and some writing by him and then documentation of all of the crazy like fan stuff that was made around the Obama campaign. And when he made the book on this website called Kickstarter, which was the first Kickstarter that I ever backed and the first time I ever heard of Kickstarter.
Same with Dan.
Yep, same with me.
and it was because he knew Charles, right? And Charles and him were friends from like Post Family in Chicago. And so he went on Kickstarter and instead of getting a publisher, and I thought that was a little weird, but I made an account and I backed it. And then Scott was having trouble finding he wanted to bind the book in cloth, right? So this is under the paper cover of the book. He wanted a cloth binding. And the cloth binding, there wasn't a cloth manufacturer that made the cloth in the correct shade of blue. As you guys know, blue is like that royal blue is like a notoriously difficult color to print because it doesn't, it just doesn't work in process. And so he wound up flying to Japan to a textile mill to create a dye to make a custom silk for the binding for the book. And he did a backer update about that. And I was like, okay, I get it. I was like, there's no publisher in the world that would have allowed this guy to do it, but it was like completely consistent with the artistic goal of the book that it had to have this special binding so that the color was right. And that was another big moment for me where I was like, okay, I get it. This is better because he doesn't have a publisher. It's not like that he couldn't get a publisher. It's actually that now he gets to make the book he wants because
he's
doesn't
like
have
unchained.
A publisher.
Yeah.
Right.
So Max, I mean, you're very articulate about this now. But do you feel like it's always like when you guys were starting cards, did it feel just as articulate, or was it more kind of intuition and over time you have like grown to be able to like articulate that and really believe in kind of that process? Because I think it's a really difficult, especially when you're starting out and you're like doing a small project, to really stick to your guns in terms of those ideals and like doing the hard thing and believing like that it will matter. I mean, has that grown in you, or?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. And I think so in the moment of making a lot of these like small decisions, it does not feel like you have, I never to me feels like you have a plan, like, you know, like the right thing is available to you and you just have to like pluck it off the tree. Like that's never how it is. Like you're always just like, scrapping and making the best decision contingent, you know, just contingently that you can from what's available. And then afterwards you have this story of like, well, I made all these decisions, so therefore like I'm a genius and they must have only been the right decisions. But you know, what's interesting too is like, I know all this stuff now and I can talk about it with you guys and it sounds really smart when I say it. But then when I go to do a project, I'm staring at the thing and going like, I don't know. I don't know if this is right. I don't know, because I do projects all the time that no one gives a shit about and they're not successful. Mm-hmm. I've put out plenty of games that nobody really cares about and they make a little bit of money on Kickstarter and then they have no life after that just because they don't catch on. So
Wanted to return to the holiday marketing campaign stuff. Every time you guys do stuff, you know, around Christmas time, I get like a sickness in the pit of my stomach just thinking about what a nightmare it would be to try to execute these things. So I don't know if you could just talk about that a little, like how these things are pulled off, like when does the brainstorming session happen, like how long is the planning, like basically how do you coordinate these things that in my mind are just a complete nightmare to execute?
Well, to your point, so it's not so the first thing I'll say about that is it's not free. Like we do a lot of work and it's really stressful, and we're actually paying for it right now. Like I am, from our holiday thing this year, I am incredibly burnt out and like I don't even want to go into work, and it's hard. Like it was so stressful and I lost so much sleep, and the team, our whole team, like pushed themselves so hard, and we were an inch away from disaster for so long that this is the critical time where we would have to be coming up with the holiday stuff that we would do this year to get it into production so that it's ready for you know, the holidays. And we're just not doing it. Like we just can't, it's just like, I just, I don't know. It just makes me sleepy if I think about doing it. So it does. So no, I mean, and I'm not being funny. Like it really does take a toll on people. And yeah, if it seems crazy, it's because it is crazy. And we probably need to. It's like not sustainable for us. Part of that, and I'll say the other piece of that is like mostly the only job experience I've had prior to working, you know, doing cards is working on political campaigns. And because of that, cards is like set up a lot like a political campaign. And that's great because it makes us really flexible and nimble and agile. And like we have these like small teams that are very empowered to like go do good stuff. And we don't have a lot of hierarchy and we can move really quickly. And, you know, it's sort of the whole thing is like built for agility and we can make quick decisions. But that's also the other thing with political campaigns is they end. They're really exhausting and you're working against this countdown clock and then it's done and you crash. And with cards, like it's never done, right? You never crash. So, like we're running this marathon that never ends, and that's
you're running every year, right? I mean, it's even worse. You're running every year, you know. And it
yeah. So anyway, so that's the first thing I would say is like there is a cost, and like we're probably not going to do a holiday thing this year just because we can't. I think we're just creatively and just drained. But anyway, the more fun part of your question of like I don't know what was it like? How do we come? Is it like how does it? Can we come up with it or?
Yeah, just like the kind of general brainstorming session and kind of planning and execution for these campaigns.
But that would start now?
Yeah, it would start. So we have a holiday retreat every year where all the guys get together and we work for about a week and we try and come up with, you know, what we want to do. We set the creative agenda for the next year. So the first year we did this, I mean, it, you know, we're always playing off of the last year a little bit. So we always have that. But the first year we did like a pay what you want pack, and that was really successful. And then so the next year we were like, what if we do like the 12 days of Christmas? And it's sort of, you know, pay what you want, but you get these gifts. And then the next year we did, what did we do next year? Kwanzaa. Was it 12 days of Christmas? And then I can't remember. And then it was Kwanzaa and then Hanukkah. And then this year was just Cards Against Humanity Saves America. Yeah. So I think typically what we do is we like come up with...
And the hole?
The hole is a Black Friday thing. So we also do a Black Friday thing every year, which is like also has to be planned and executed like at the same time. It's
One of my favorite Black Friday ones was that you just made the game $10 more expensive or something.
Yeah,
it was the Cards Against Humanity Black Friday $5 more sale.
That was So that one, except for the whole, then that like the Black Friday one seems like a more simple, typically.
Yes, that's because that's like one joke usually, and usually it involves people giving us money to do something stupid. Whereas the holiday thing usually involves giving us money to get presents in the mail. But so basically what we do is we try to come up with an editorial tone or a perspective. Like comedy is best when it has a perspective, when you have like some sort of worldview, because when you have a clearly articulated worldview, the comedy comes really easily, right? That's how people like Louis C.K. are able to write an hour of comedy every single year. It's because the guy has a funny worldview, so anything he does, if he goes into Starbucks to get a coffee, it's funny because it's the world colliding with his worldview. So we try to develop a worldview an idea that sort of fits with the theme that we're doing for the year. And then we sort of start from the perspective of like, what are crazy things we could do? And then we try and like meet in the middle. So like I'm trying to think of a good example. So for like Hanukkah, right? Like we wanted to do something, we're all Jewish. So we wanted to do something that was like, you know, letting people in on all of the weird inside jokes of Hanukkah. So one of them is like for the first 3 days, we sent everyone a pair of socks. Cause for the first days of Hanukkah, you always get, it's technically a bunch of days, but you get like shitty presents for the first 3 days. And then we had like our dads write letters of advice for each day of Hanukkah. So that everyone could hear our dads like giving embarrassing advice. So, you know, I don't know, like we tried to come up with stuff with stuff like that. And like, oh my God, like I don't even remember what, did we buy people the castle that year? Or I can't even, it's all blurs. Yeah. It blurs.
It's about an island that year.
The island, yeah, I don't remember. But then we always try to come up with, and it's like another thing for that we figured out is like, we try and think about like, what's something that what's something that one person couldn't do, but like 100,000 people can do? So like buying a piece of property, right? Or like another, like another one we were thinking about is like, okay, what if you were like a really irresponsible rich person? It's like one of these like rich Saudi like princes who like flies around in like a gold airplane with his falcons, right? Like what would you do? And then we came up with the idea of like that you would buy a baseball team just because it would be funny. And that's what, that's how we came up with the idea of doing the baseball stadium for this year. So it, a lot of that comes out of like the comedy perspective, and then we do have a we're also very like we can be pretty pessimistic as a group, and we're a skeptical group, like we are skeptical personalities. So as soon as me or Ben or whoever Eli can throw out an idea of like, well, what if we buy a private island, someone else will say that's impossible, like we could, it could never be done because what if someone trips and falls and breaks their leg, like the, everyone is good at finding those things like immediately. And so we've sort of developed this rule of something I heard do you guys know the movie Hotel Rwanda? So it's the real life guy from the movie Hotel Rwanda that was a hotel manager that saved a bunch of people during the Rwandan genocide. This dude, Paul Rusesabagina, and I used to work for his foundation. And I was in a meeting with Paul one time where we were going to make this outlandish ask of the Rwanda government that they were never going to say yes to. And everyone in the room, Paul was like, we should just ask them to do this. And everyone in the room was like, Paul, you can't ask them for that. They're going to say no. And he was just like, why don't we let them tell us no? And I was like, that's the smartest thing I've ever heard in my life. Like, why? Like, don't tell yourself no, right? Like, if, even if the answer is no, like, let them tell you that. Yeah. And sure enough, we got most of what we wanted just for asking. So that was a good, that was a valuable lesson for me. So we've sort of adopted that rule when we're doing the brainstorming stuff of we're like, let's let someone else tell us no. Like, let's not tell ourselves no until, like, okay. So we'll write it down. Like, it's a valid concern. What if someone slips and breaks their leg? But then we can, like, call our lawyer and say, one of our many highly priced lawyers that gives us contradictory and expensive advice. and we could say, like, what do we do in this scenario?
I can imagine, like, when they had the caller ID and they see someone's calling for you guys, like, whoa.
I bet they say, this will be interesting.
Yeah, like, what is it now?
our lawyers are generally pretty cool, and they like what we do, and I think where we've picked the right people, I mean, this is good advice for anyone doing any project, like, I feel very strongly about this way for if you pick a lawyer who you're going to work with, or also if you pick a developer that you're going to work with. Don't work with people who tell you no. Work with people who say, it can be done, but here's the cost.
Yeah.
That's right. That's the right partner, right? It's not up to anyone else to tell you no. It's up to
Then they're an actual partner opposed to like a drag.
Right. Yeah, anyone can tell you. I already know the reasons why we can't do it. Like, I'm looking for the way to do it.
Yeah. Or I guess at least someone who will try, right? Like, you at least want someone who's going to go, let me see. Right, like I'll see if we can do
it. Tell us, you know, if it's like, if we're buying the island and then we need some insane insurance policy that's going to bankrupt our company and it's going to, you know, it's going to be unfeasible. Well, then we'll decide that at that point. But let's not, you know, why don't we put that on the table and see what it looks like? And sometimes it's not as bad as you imagine.
Yeah, so I don't want to get too into the weeds on kind of like the financial side, but I've always been curious. Again, like every time I see a new holiday campaign, I'm just like, how are they shipping all these things for like, you know, $15 or whatever? Are they, do you view them basically as like a money loser, but the promotional aspect obviously like makes up for it? Or like how do you kind of budget and just basically view these campaigns in that way?
Yeah, so our goal for all of this stuff is the goal is break even. And usually we don't do that. Usually we lose a little bit of money. So I think on this holiday thing, we actually made about 50 grand, which on the grand scheme of, I mean, I can...
It's not very much percentage-wise.
Yeah. Right, exactly. I'm going to open up Solver and I'll put it in. So we have 150,000 subscribers and they each paid us, I think it was at $25 this year. So it was $3.7 million. And we came in and we allocated that money to the whatever the 8 days, and we came in and we wound up 50 grand under. So that's like almost right. That's like almost hitting a bullseye with the budget. And that's fine. Cause then what we hope is that it's promotional and that it makes people play the, so we have two goals. We want the top goal is we want people to buy the game, right? So maybe you see something funny we do and you go online and you buy Cards Against Humanity. But the second goal we have is we just want people to play the game. Because if people just see something funny we do, if one of our existing fans sees something funny we do, takes Cards Against Humanity off the shelf and plays it, they might play the game with someone who will then have a good time and buy the game. So that's the best. That's really the best marketing we can have, is if people just play the game with their friends. That's the nice thing about cards, is you can't play it alone. So you like have to play it with friends. And then we think that there's a pretty high conversion rate of people playing the game to like going online and buying it.
Yeah. So one thing that we always...
I just thought of something. I'm sorry to cut you off. I just thought of something, which is you guys do the same thing in product design, because I have all the Studio Neat bullshit lying around my house and I leave it out. And I leave it out because it looks cool, because it's really beautiful product design. So it doesn't go in the counter with all of my other, you know, like I have all my Neat Ice stuff like hanging up on little hooks in my kitchen. And then people come over and they go, oh, what's that? Right? Huh.
Interesting. Yeah.
That's good to hear.
That is part of the marketing of what you guys do.
Yeah, well, yeah, that we don't think, I was actually, when you were talking about, like, how your second kind of metric is, like, we want people to play the game, you know, I was like, man, I wish, in my brain, I was like, man, I wish we had, you know, products that kind of more lent themselves to that sort of thing, but I think that's like, that almost feels like it, like, for us, I mean, and really for, I think, most people, that should be, like, the first goal, it's just, like, getting people to use your thing.
We thought about this too. So when we were designing the packaging for cards, I mean, it could have been anything, right? Like now I think it's somewhat like iconic.
Yeah, it is.
That we did what we did, but you know, when you have a design like that, like you know, like the iPod, right? Like it seems inevitable in retrospect. Like, oh, of course the iPod had to be like that. But you guys have seen all the crazy prototypes of the iPod where it had like a keyboard on it and stuff. Yeah. Right? So like, it's not inevitable. It could have been anything, and they just went with the one that they went with, and. Yeah. One of the factors that we were considering when we were like thinking about packaging was, so we had this idea of like, maybe if we make something that's cool enough, that's like enough of basically a design object, people will leave it out on their coffee table, and then their friends will come over and say, what's that? Because it grabs your eye. And you know, I don't know. I mean, I think we probably succeeded more than like an average board game at making something that's, you know, cool enough that you could leave out on the table. But that's always been like a goal.
It's shocking to me that like, you know, kind of a minimal, straightforward approach to like visual design is still striking. You know, like it's the fact that there's like not a ton of stuff going on and it's just like well considered and simple. That's still like right there. You're like, you know, standing above the crowd still, which is kind of like very odd that is like still the case.
Well, but that's the goal, right? Is like forget the idea of designing the best board game. Like that is not the goal of design. That's the goal of art. Yeah. And if you're making products, you're not an artist, you're a designer. And design is about, the difference is art is a self-expression or a communication with the viewer, and it's about, you know, aesthetics and communicating something or imbuing this thing with some sort of meaning to you. And that's fine. I mean, I'm not anti-art, but if you're trying to make a game packaging that's successful, that's fundamentally not an art question. It's a design question. And design is solving a problem. So the problem we wanted to solve is like, this is a very crowded market. There's a billion games out there. So the problem we wanted to solve is, how do we make something that is different than everything else on the shelf, where if you're looking at a big crowded game shelf, your eye goes to our thing. And you know, it was sort of process of elimination of like, you know, okay, like big solid colors, clean typography, good graphic design, you know, put it on a grid.
Classic Coke classic. So I think that's like a pretty universal like advice, but one thing that I think we struggle with is Studio Neat, when we like look at the stuff you guys are doing and it's done so well, we're envious. We're like, man, why can't we, like, you know, like approach
wait, is that
marketing
from,
like
wait that? A minute. Is that from the Michael Beirut thing in Helvetica where he's talking about you're crawling through the desert and you're dying of thirst? And he's, you do. He's such a fucking nut. And he's like, can you see this crisp typography? It's like a cool glass of water.
Drink, period. Coke, period. That scene is so awesome. It seems like so good. So, like, the thing we always tell ourselves when we like think about trying to do something marketing that's kind of more attention getting is it feels like, man, we can't do that. Like cards can get away with it because they're like brand is about humor and like, you know, all that stuff. Do you think that some of your approach to marketing can extend itself to like, and I don't mean like in a deep, like, I don't mean like the fundamentals, but I mean like literally in the way you guys, you really, I guess there's like a big push and pull and there's like a lot of tension and your marketing is like pretty aggressive, I guess. Do you think that approach, it extends itself to, you know, companies that make like a very like a chair or like something almost like banal. Do you think that it extends itself, or because you're like, it's based in comedy, you can get away with a lot of stuff? I mean, how do you think about that?
Yeah, so this is from, I have this idea from our very, very funny and brilliant community manager, Jen Bain, who helped kind of come up with this card's voice that you're talking about. She was like our first employee and very, very influential, and now kind of is in charge of that. Jen and I talk about the idea that Cards Against Humanity is a character, kind of like Stephen Colbert from the Colbert Report. So like, there's basically a character that we do, and then there's the reality of the situation. And so imagine imagine a customer service email that we would get, right? I got a game and it was missing a bunch of cards, right? It was defective from the place that I bought it. Mm-hmm. So in our email back to that person, there's two functions that have to be served. The first function is we always solve their problem. We recognize their problem and solve it compassionately and generously. That's first. So in any situation, you know, even on social media or anything we're doing, or to use an example you're asking about from marketing, right? If we're explaining a new promotion that we're doing, the first duty is to clearly articulate what we're doing. Like, what is this? Like, why? What are you looking at? Right. So we always say, like, this is a new expansion pack. It costs $10. It has 30 cards. You know, you mix it in with your game. Like, we always explain it from first principles, like you've never heard of what we're doing before. And that's the first master, is like clarity and like an actual solution to the problem of the user. And then there's the character can come in, and the character has this sort of cynical, you know, it's sort of like a minimalist, like we do a lot of like one word replies, right? Like, like that kind of a thing. Like, and our customers like that. Like, they like getting, they expect that from us, and they feel included when we give them like a snarky, shitty reply.
Yeah, they're in on the joke too. I mean, they get,
right.
Yeah.
But yeah, it only works if we're solving their problem. If it's, and we reject, you have no idea. Everything we do has a draft that's like really funny and mean and in voice, and it gets rejected because it doesn't actually explain what we're doing, right? So we'll stare. So I'll stare at it and I'll blink and I'll go like, I don't know what this is. Like, it's funny, but I don't know what we're doing. Like, let me, oh my God, I have, let me see if I can, if I can't, oh no, wait, I think it's in this, I have so many text editors. When we do Cards Against Humanity emails, we do these like brainstorms of what the subject line is going to be. And I want to see if I can track one of these down, because it's a great illustration of what I'm talking about, of like, we do these like super weird pieces of writing that don't make any sense, and then they have to be dialed back into explaining what's going on. The one I'm looking for is just called, I think it's just called Here Comes Owls. Oh, here we go. Okay, subject lines for an email. So this was announcing our Hanukkah promotion. So basically what it needs to say in the email is like, we are doing a thing for Hanukkah, and you can give us $15 and you get a bunch of presents in the mail, right? And here was the subject lines that we started with. Hot news, hot sex news, hot cross buns, hot takes, extra, extra, fresh news here, coming through, fresh news, make way for news, news is happening, inside this email, colon, the news, get ready for it, colon, an email, flaming hot news and Cheetos, crunchy news morsels, chow down on this hot news slop, regarding dog food, some interesting new facts are coming your way, who would have guessed, it's an email, holy a Hanukkah email is here. Hanukkah is coming. And then finally the one that we went with, which is Here Comes Hanukkah. So like, we went through, there were like a lot of different funny, like any of those are funny and in voice, but then it was like, we just had to keep, that probably represents an hour of work of three people, by the way, just like, just banging their heads against the screen going like, how do we get the voice that we want and the information, right? Like, so it's like easy to be funny and come up with some bullshit of like, you know, flaming hot news or whatever, but like, it's hard, but then the problem is no one knows what the fuck you're talking about.
Yep. Yeah. Because it, like, and you can see the progression through those as well, which I quite like, right? You can see how you went from one joke to the other. But you're right. What you landed on is something that tells part of the story of the product that you're eventually selling. Because, like, re-dog food is hilarious, and definitely people would open that email, but it's got nothing to do with what you ended up doing.
Right. I'm looking at it. I'm just going through my list here, and I found another one. And this one, we only did three headlines. And so it started off as big, strong email. And then the second one was get ready for email. And then the one we eventually landed on was jam on this funky email. And I believe... And I believe that that's the worst performing email we've ever sent out.
That's interesting, because it doesn't say anything.
It doesn't say anything. Nothing. We came up with jam on this funky email, and we were like, that's the funniest thing that anyone has ever said.
So I used to work in financial services marketing, right? I worked in a bank, and I used to send out emails. And the very, very best performing emails were always the ones that said sorry in the subject line. any apology got like a 100% open rate.
Yeah,
everything else nobody cared about.
People need it from a bank.
It said sorry, like it said name of bank, sorry, or we made a mistake, like you can 100% guess that every single person would open them, which led to many conversations of like, how can I send out this marketing email with the word sorry in it?
A message from Hillary Clinton. Hillary wants to have lunch with you.
That's right. She's really nice. So, but all that process felt very like improv-y, like comedy improv-y to me.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm wondering, like, if your voice wasn't comedy, right? If it was, you know, sincerity or something, do you feel... like it would, that process would work the same way. I don't know. To me, it just feels it's like it is different for some. I don't know. It does seem different that it's comedy.
Improv didn't start as comedy, right? It started as theater. So I mean, you can the process of improv that I think you're describing is like there's kind of like a yes and process where someone throws out and someone's like hot news, and then you know it's so in that email brainstorm. I actually remember exactly where we were when we did that, and that was me and Eli and Jen, and we sat there for an hour and wrote those. And Eli would go hot news, and then any one of us could have gone shut up, you fucking idiot, that doesn't make any sense, right? But you don't do that. You go yes, and it's not just hot news; it's flaming hot news. Like, and you just start and you just write them down, right? Because it's like who knows, like any you know, you just let it go, and you trust that you're like working with smart people and. If you want to push it in a certain direction, like take what they're doing and then add to it instead of you know grappling with it, and that process works. I mean, it's great for comedy, but it's good for, you know, like I said, like the improv works in you know real theater too.
Mm-hmm. So would you say that like for I mean Black Box definitely has, but say something that's like one of your smaller projects like the Zine, would you say that has like a pretty clearly defined voice in your head and like. Has that or is it not there?
The zine you're talking about is like a little Kickstarter project that I did that I never actually finished that I need to finish. That's it was just 12 issues of a zine of like collections of stuff that I'm like reading currently basically on different topics. And it does have a theme. It does that one. I don't work with anyone else on it, so it's just me. And it does have a voice in the sense that I consider 100 things for each zine and only like whatever 15 of them make it in, and I know when I look at them I'm like that one's right, that one's wrong, so like there is a quality, but I couldn't explain it to anyone. It doesn't make sense to anyone outside of my head, but I do hope that like when you read all that stuff together, like something comes through in the like spaces between them, but but that's the nice thing about working with just by myself. It's like I don't really have to make it make sense to anyone else.
So we want to start wrapping up, and, you know, I'm going to pick one of, like, three different ways that you can wrap up an interview.
Wait, what are the three ways?
Well, so you've got... Okay, so I can tell you a couple of them. So the one that I'm going to ask you is, like, where do you see things going in the future? Another is, like, turning it back on me and making it all about me, right? So, like, I'll ask you some questions.
The Marin?
Yeah. It is A-style. So, you know, I can make it like, oh, this is so great what you're saying. It reminds me of this thing that I have to promote, right? So that's one way to do it. And then the other one is just to cut the conversation completely dead. Right? So the conversation just ends, you know, and then the music starts. So what I am going to ask you is, you know, you mentioned that you were a little bit like kind of tired now, right? From what was sounded like a really tough project that you were running over the last few months, right? With the holiday stuff. And then I guess kind of the fallout of that takes a lot out of you, right? The press part B in the fallout, which is when all eyes are on you.
Yeah, and then like roughly 300,000 customer service emails.
Yeah, right? Like dealing with what you have to deal with when something of such a scale.
Let me get my solver out here one more time. So let's see, so we have 3,750,000 people, and let's times that by a 2% mail failure rate. And that's which is pretty good, and that's 75,000 emails right there. Oh, wait a minute, wait! But it's times 7. But it's times 8 days.
Yeah,
hang on. Mm. But times 8 days, 600,000 emails.
Mm.
So you're dealing with stuff like that, and you mentioned that, like, as you stand right now, which I can totally understand, like, you don't think that you want to do something for this year. So what are the types of areas that you would be focusing on throughout the rest of the year? Like, what if you're not going to do something of that kind of scale? Is it a case of looking at what you currently do and seeing how you can improve it, or does you and the team kind of relax? Like, where does the focus go if it's not on something so huge?
Well I don't know. I don't have an answer for that. For me, I just sort of try to follow what I want to work. There is an element of, like, I'm a very undisciplined person, and it's very, very, I'm like a notorious procrastinator. I'm late to everything, and it's very, very hard for me to, like, do something that I don't want to do. Like, I never learned this skill in life, and I, to my great frustration, like, I can never just, like, sit down and work on something. So, you know, I'd spend a lot of, like, I just sort of follow, like, what sounds fun to work on, and that can change from day to day. Like, some days it's like I have, you know, oh, I want to, like, get, you know, do some of my work for one of these, like, campaigns that I'm working on. Or some days, like, there's a cards project, or some days it's something like my zine, or, you know, a game that I'm working on. Like, so I try to have, like, a couple of different, what's the thing that you have in the oven?
Irons.
I try and have a couple of irons in the oven, and then
you have irons in the fire. Irons, you have buns in the oven, but you don't have those.
Okay, whatever. Close enough. I have some of those things. The irons and the buns, and then I can just switch, right? And, like, yeah, that's the only cope. I mean, it's kind of a coping mechanism. I heard this thing. I wish I remember where I heard this, but I heard, like, a design talk from someone that really stuck with me. And it might've been from this designer, Margot Harrington, that I really like. But basically the idea was, you know, design is almost this impossible family of skills. So if you break down, like, what it is to be a designer, there is composition and color theory and typography and printing. And you could even start to get into, like, coding and UX and copywriting. It's basically illustration. It's basically a set of skills that it is nearly impossible for one person to master in a lifetime. And every designer has things that they just don't know how to do and that they're not very good at. And so you develop, as a designer, you develop crutches. So for me, like, I'm a shit illustrator. Like, I really cannot illustrate anything at all. So my crutch is that I figure out things to do instead of illustration, and I use a lot of copywriting and typography, and I, like, lean on other things. And the point of this talk was, like, those crutches that you develop, that's your style. Like, that's not separate from what's good about you as a designer. That is what's good about you as a designer. It's like, you pick the things that you pick the things you're good at, you compensate for the things you're bad at, and that's a style, right? That's a career. Similarly, like, I think that's true of people's, like, work habits. And for me, like, I just try to have enough things going at once that if I'm really bored or depressed or can't focus on something, like, there's, like, at least one thing that calls out to me of, like, okay, I can go do this one.
What's your favorite thing right now?
What is my favorite thing right now? I can't really say. It's, we haven't announced it. We don't pre-announce anything, but Cards is a kind of a new crazy thing that I've wanted to do for almost my whole life that's probably pretty irresponsible. It's like a new business. And the Cards partners have said no for a long time, and now I think they said they just took pity on me and said yes, and it's kind of like getting together a new team and starting this whole new project that's probably not going to succeed, and hopefully it's not like a complete public humiliation. But that's probably the thing I'm most scared and most excited by it, and those are, like, probably related. Like, I don't know. How do you guys feel this? Like, I kind of like working on stuff that's a little bit scary. That's kind of where I do my best work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I think when it's completely new and we don't have a bunch of assumptions kind of, like, blocking us, and, we're just kind of diving into like a new kind of product or new kind of like manufacturing process, and we can be like dumb. Because I find myself, you know, saying no to Dan a lot, like, oh, that's too hard or too expensive. And then like later we'll find out that like I was just wrong. And that like sucks when that happens. Like we've wasted a bunch of time and work. And so it's nice when, you know, you're just like dumb about everything.
You know, there is that element of it, and you know, that beginner's mind, but then there's also the element of, I personally find that fear of public humiliation is a terrific motivator. Like, I find it highly motivational.
Yeah, I guess that's like Kickstarter for us. It's like working in that same mode where like Kickstarter is so awesome at motivation, because you just like, you know, you've already promised, you've made your promises basically.
Yeah, it's kind of like I got in, there was like a time in my life where I got really into boxing, and like I've never been interested in any sport in my life. I find them like exquisitely boring, and I can't do them or focus on them at all. But there's just something about boxing where like I just found that the desire to not get punched in the face was highly motivational.
Well, so did you train? Like, were you sparring
yeah.
all that stuff?
Yeah.
I would say that the easiest way to not get punched in the face is not to box. That's my outlook on life.
Yeah, I did eventually optimize to that solution as well.
Max, thank you so much for joining us. It has been an
yeah.
Absolute
wait, I
pleasure.
One more. I
you
more,
have one more
no,
thing.
Okay, I have one more thing that I just thought of. So, which with regards to like what you guys were talking about, which that you say no. If you know, the more you know about it, the more you say no to stuff. Mm-hmm. I heard this amazing story from Rodney Thompson, who's the guy who made Lords of Waterdeep. Do you guys play board games at all? I actually don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Do you guys know Lords of Waterdeep?
I don't know that one.
I don't know, not that one.
Oh, you guys have got to check this game out. So it was put out by Wizards of the Coast. I think it's one of the best and most beautiful games ever made. So it's by two guys. I have to look it up. It's by Rodney Thompson and Peter Lee. And I heard this amazing story. I've asked Rodney a million times. I know Rodney really well, and I've asked him a million times, like, how the fuck did you come up with this one thing or that thing in the game? Because it's like the most elegant little design or the most elegant little system in the game. And, you know, that's a horrible question. You never can answer that as a designer. You're like, I don't know. Yeah. It was a lot of hard work and we tried a lot of ideas and those didn't work. And then we stuck with the one that did work. Mm-hmm. But the one Rodney told me this one thing that him and Peter developed. So they also had a somewhat like, you know, kind of like I have with the cards guys. They had a respectful but like adversarial relationship. And which is healthy. Like, you know, they would get into like healthy disagreements about stuff. Mm-hmm. And they created this rule for working together, like a law of how they would work with each other, where you were always allowed to say at any moment, what if we did? And so what you say is this, not this, right? Because this is a terrible idea. But what if we do something like this? And then you say your idea. And then you're just allowed to say that. And the other mm-hmm. person's not allowed to like jump down your throat. Yeah. And I steal that, like, anytime I work with people now, we, like, establish that as a rule of, like, you're always allowed to say, not this, but what about this?
Yeah, like, we're not going to do this crazy thing.
Mm. Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. This would be insane and wrong. Like, we couldn't possibly do this. But what about something like this, you know? And then what it does is it invites everyone as, like, a participant in solving the problem rather than coming up with ways that it won't work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know. The thing that is striking to me about talking to you and knowing more about cards, it seems like the secret sauce of cards is this like relationship of the founders and how it you guys are seem to be so good at like brainstorming and working with each other and like that relationship. So that's like that's really cool. I wish I saw more of that. Like you guys like exposed more of that process, but.
Yeah, they're just super not interested in it. Like none of them want to do interviews. mm-hmm. None of them want. Yeah, they just enjoy. I mean, the other thing is like we all have other jobs. We all do other stuff. So for some mm-hmm. of them, they're in like academia or something, and it would be weird if their name when you Googled their name, it came up with this card game. So that's kind of part of it. Mm.
Max, I want to thank you for joining us. You've been a fantastic guest for the show, and we really appreciate your time. I will. Recommend that everybody go and check out Dubai Friday if they haven't already, which is a podcast that Max is a host of, which is a challenge podcast. So every week there is a challenge set.
Challenge.
And the participants of the show, which also include Alex Cox and Merlin Mann.
Hey, what was the idea that you and Tiff were going to do that we did first?
It was called, well, okay, so we had a demo of this show, which I think actually does predate Dubai Friday. It exists out on the internet. And it was called I Love to Test. And the idea was that we would pick something and the three of us would try it out every episode. But it wasn't...
Who's the third person?
It was also my partner, Adina.
Ah. Oh, man, that's a good show. You guys should still do that.
No, because we don't have... So, okay, so this probably shouldn't stay in the episode, but anyway, we're in this now. the difference was it wasn't a challenge. That was the little thing that you came up with that made it the perfect idea. Because we recorded a test episode, and we just were not completely happy with the idea. Like, the idea, the core idea still needed work. And I think the biggest difference for with Dubai Friday, which is a fantastic show, I mean, aside from the fact that the three of you are fantastic together, but just, like, the core idea of the show, the difference was the challenge.
So funny that you say that, because we tried so hard to come up with an idea for a podcast to do together, like, after we did our stupid Top Chef show, and we did the challenge idea with such resignation, you could not believe it. It was such a defeat. And we had to drag Merlin, like, screaming and crying like a little baby.
I hate you so much.
And I was defending the idea, because I was like, no, we'll just do it. It'll be funny. Like, it'll work. And Merlin was like, I knew in the back of my head, I was like, this idea is kind of, as you say, Mike, it's a bit shit.
That is exactly what I said. I'm well known for that. It's a catchphrase. So there you go. I mean, so we did this in July of 2016.
And John Siracusa, Merlin told the idea to Siracusa, and Siracusa goes, sounds like a fun podcast to do, but not a fun podcast to listen to.
Oh.
Well, you all showed him, because Dubai Friday is one of my favorites. It is a fantastic show, and people should go and listen to it. Max, is there anything else that you wanna send people towards, aside from, of course, Cards Against Humanity?
No.
Okay, great. That was why I decided to promote Dubai Friday, because I figured you wouldn't. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Thoroughly Considered. You can find links and information about the show at relay.fm/tc/35. Thanks again to Max Temkin for joining us as our first guest, but most of all, thank you for listening.